word that didn't seem to belong in the new world. Gansey read the Latin on the rock again. The translation seemed obvious once Ronan had done the heavy lifting. And then, like the others, he looked around at the surrounding trees. "What is this thing you've done?" he asked himself. "Where have you brought them?" "I vote we find water," Blue said, "to make the energy do whatever Ronan said it would do that was better. And then I think we should say something in Latin."
"It sounds like a plan," Gansey agreed, wondering at the strangeness of this place, that such a nonsensical suggestion should seem so practical. "Should we go back the way we came, or go farther in?"
Noah said, "Farther." Since Noah rarely expressed an opinion, his word reigned. Setting off again, they doubled back and forth across their own trail in search of water. And as they walked, the leaves fell around them, red and then brown and then gray, until the trees were naked. Frost appeared in the shadows.
"Winter," Adam said.
It was impossible, of course, but again, so was everything that had come before it. It was, Gansey thought, like when he'd driven through the Lake District with Mallory. After a while, there had been too much incredible beauty for him to process, and it had become invisible. It was impossible that it was winter, but it was no more impossible than anything else that had happened. They had come to a stand of naked willow trees on a gentle slope, and below them was the twist of a slow-moving, shallow creek. Mallory had once told Gansey that where there were willows, there was water. "Willows propagated," he said, "by dropping seeds and moving water that then carried them downstream, allowing them to root on some distant shore."
"And," Blue added, "there's water."
Gansey turned to the others. Their breath came in clouds, and they all looked badly underdressed. Even the color of their skin looked wrong, too sun-flushed for this colorless winter air. Tourists from another season. He became aware that he was shivering, but he didn't know if it was from the newly winter cold or from anticipation.
"Okay," he said to Blue. "What did you want to say in Latin?"
Blue turned to Ronan. "Can you just say hello? That's polite."
Ronan looked pained. Polite was not his style, but he said, "Salve." To Blue, he said, "That actually means be well."
"Super job," she replied. "Ask if they'll speak with us."
Now Ronan looked even more pained because this made him look ridiculous, and that was even less his style, but he tilted his head back to the treetops and said,
"Loquere tu nobis."
They all stood quietly. A hiss seemed to be rising, as if a faint winter breeze rustled the leaves in the trees. But there were no leaves left on the branches to rustle.
"Nothing," Ronan replied. "What did you expect?"
"Quiet," ordered Gansey, because now the hissing was definitely more than a rustle. Now it had resolved into what sounded distinctly like whispered, dry voices. "Do you hear that?" Everyone but Noah shook their heads.
"I do," said Noah to Gansey's relief.
Gansey said, "Ask them to say it again." Ronan did. The hissing rustle came again, and now it seemed obvious that it was a voice. Obvious that it had never been leaves. Plainly, Gansey heard a crackly statement in Latin. He wished suddenly that he'd studied harder in class as he repeated the words phonetically to Ronan.
"They say they've been speaking to you already, but you haven't been listening," Ronan said. He rubbed the back of his shaved head. "Gansey, are you messing with me? Do you really hear something?"
"Do you think Gansey's Latin is that good?" Adam replied tersely. "It was your handwriting on the rock, Ronan, that said they spoke Latin. Shut up." The trees hissed again, and Gansey repeated them to Ronan. Noah corrected one of the verbs Gansey had misheard. Ronan's eyes darted to Blue.
"They said they're happy to see the psychic's daughter."
"Me?" Blue cried. The trees hissed a reply, and Gansey repeated the words.
"I don't know what that means," Ronan said. "They're also happy to once more see... I don't know what that word is. Gray Warren? If it's Latin, I don't know it."
"Ronan,"
whispered the trees.
Ronan Lynch.
It's you, Gansey said with wonder, his skin creeping. Ronan Lynch. They said your name. It's you they're happy to see again. Ronan's expression was guarded, his feelings hidden. Again? Blue pressed her hands to her cold red cheeks, her eyes wide, her face holding all the awe and excitement that Gansey felt.
Amazing. The trees? Amazing. Adam asked, why can only you and Noah hear them?
In stumbling Latin, even in class he rarely spoke it, and it was strange to try to translate his thoughts from words he could see written in his head to spoken ones. Gansey said, hic gaudemus, gratias tibi, loquere, loqui pro nobis. He looked at Ronan. How do I ask why you can't hear them?
God, Gansey, if you paid attention and...
Closing his eyes, Ronan thought for a moment.
Cur nomte audimus?
Gansey didn't need Ronan to translate the tree's hushed answer. The Latin was simple enough. He said aloud, the road isn't awake.
The ley line, Blue suggested.
A little wistfully, she added, but that doesn't explain why only you and Noah can hear it. The trees murmured,
si experga facere via erimus in debitum.
If you wake the line, they'll be in your debt, Ronan said.
For a moment, they were all quiet, then looking at one another. It was a lot to take in, because it wasn't merely that the trees were speaking to them. It was that the trees themselves were sentient beings, capable of watching their movements. Was it only the trees in this strange wood, or did every tree observe their movements? Had they always been trying to speak to them? There was no way of knowing either if the trees were good or bad, if they loved or hated humans, if they had principles or compassion. They were like aliens, Gansey thought. Aliens that we have treated very badly for a very long time. If I were a tree, I would have no reason to love a human. It was happening. All of these years he had been looking for this. Gansey said, ask them if they know where Glendower is. Adam looked startled. Without pausing, Ronan translated. It took a moment for the hissing voices to reply, and again, Gansey didn't need a translation. No, Gansey said. Something inside him had tightened and tightened and tightened until he'd asked the question. He'd thought hearing the answer would release it, but it didn't. Everyone else was looking at him. He wasn't sure why. Maybe something in his face was wrong. It felt wrong. He looked away from them all and said, it's very cold. Walde frigida. What's the way out? Please. Amabo te ubi exitum. The trees whispered and hissed, and Gansey realized he might have been mistaken. It might have been only one voice all along. He wasn't entirely sure he'd ever heard it aloud either, now that he thought about it. It was possible that it had been said directly in his head this entire time. It was a disconcerting thought, and it distracted his listening. Noah had to help him recall everything that had been said, and Ronan had to think for a very long moment before he was able to translate.
Sorry, Ronan said. He was concentrating too hard to remember to look cool or surly. It's difficult. They said that we need to go back through the year, against the road, the line. They said if we go back along the creek and turn left at the big sycamore, Platanus, I think sycamore, then we'll find something they think we want to find. Then we'll be able to walk out of the woods and find our way back to our day. I don't know. I missed parts, but I think... I'm sorry.
It's okay, Gansey said. You're doing really well. In a low voice, he asked Adam, do you think we should do it? It occurs to me they might not be trusted. Adam's furrowed brow meant that this had occurred to him as well, but he replied, do we have another choice? I think we should trust them, Blue said. They knew me and Ronan, somehow, and the rock didn't say not to, right?
She had a point. Ronan's handwriting, with its great care to prove its origin to them, had given them the key to speak to the trees, not a warning.
Back we go, Ganzi said. Careful not to slip. Then louder he said, Gratias! Reveniemus!
What did you say? Blue asked.
Adam replied for him, Thanks, and that we be back. It wasn't difficult to adhere to the directions Ronan had translated. The creek was wide here, the water cold and slow between white frosted banks. Following it took them steadily downhill, and gradually the air around them began to warm. Sparse red leaves spotted the branches, and by the time Blue pointed out a massive sycamore, the peeling white and gray trunk too wide for her to put her arms around, they were in the sticky grips of summer. The leaves were full and green, moving and rubbing against one another in a constant murmured rustle. If there was a voice now, Ganzi wasn't certain he'd hear it.
We missed summer before, Adam pointed out, when we came the other way. We went straight to fall.
Magical mosquitoes, Ronan said, smacking his arm. What a great place this is.
Following the voice's directions, they turned left at the massive sycamore. Ganzi wondered what it was that the trees thought they would want to find. He thought there was only one thing he was looking for. Then the trees opened up into a summery clearing, and it became obvious what the voice had meant. In the clearing, entirely out of place, was an abandoned car, a red Mustang, newer model. At first it appeared to be covered with mud, but a closer inspection revealed that it was in fact coated with layers and layers of pollen and leaf litter. Leaves had caught in drifts in the cracks of the hood and under the spoiler, gathered over the windshield wipers and bunched around the tires. A sapling grew out from under the car, wrapping around the front fender. The scene was reminiscent of old shipwrecks, ancient boats turned into coral reefs by the wiles of time. Behind the car stretched a badly overgrown track that seemed to lead out of the woods. This must have been the way out, the trees meant.
Bling, Ronan remarked, kicking one of the tires. The Mustang had massive, expensive wheels, and now that Ganzi looked more closely at the car, he saw that it was covered with aftermarket details. Big rims, new spoiler, dark window tint, gaping exhaust.
New money, his father would have said, burns in the pocket.
Look, Adam said. He rubbed a finger over the dust of the back window. Next to a Blink 182 sticker was an Aglenby decal.
Figures, Blue said.
Ronan tried the driver's side door. It came open. He laughed, once sharp.
There's a mummified hamburger in here.
They all crowded around to see the interior. But apart from the dry, half-eaten hamburger on the passenger seat, still sitting on its wrapper, there was not much to see. This car, too, was a riddle, like Blue's voice on the recorder. Ganzi felt as if it was directed specifically at him.
Pop the trunk, he ordered. The trunk had a jacket in it, and beneath that an odd collection of sticks and springs. Frowning, Ganzi withdrew the contraption, holding it by the largest rod. The pieces swung into place, several sticks hanging and twisting beneath the main one, and he understood all at once. It's a dowsing rod. He turned to Adam, wanting verification.
Coincidence, Adam said, of course meaning that it wasn't.
Ganzi had the peculiar sensation he had first felt in the parking lot outside Nino's when Adam had warned him that he thought someone else was looking for the ley line. Then he realized that Blue and Noah were no longer in sight.
Where's Blue and Noah?
At her name, Blue reappeared, stepping over a log and back into the clearing. She said, Noah's throwing up.
Why is he doing that? Ganzi asked. Is he sick?
I'll ask him, she replied. As soon as he's finished puking,
Ganzi winced. I think you'll find that Ganzi prefers the word vomiting or evacuating, Ronan said brightly.
I think retching is the most specific word in this case, Blue corrected pointedly.
Retching, said Ronan without concern. This finally was something he knew something about. Where is he? Noah!
He pushed away from the Mustang and started back the way that Blue had come. Blue noticed the dowsing rod in Gansey's hands.
Was that in the car? A dowsing rod?
He shouldn't have been surprised she knew what it was. Even if she wasn't psychic, her mother was, and this was technically a tool of the trade. The trunk.
But that means that someone else was looking for the ley line.
On the other side of the Mustang, Adam drew his fingers through the pollen on the side of the car. He looked disquieted.
And they decided it was more important than their car.
Gansey glanced up at the trees around them, then back at the expensive car. In the distance, he heard the low voices of Ronan and Noah. I think we'd better go. I think we need more information.
27.
As Blue got ready to go out the following Sunday morning, she was officially conflicted. Sundays were dog walking days. Actually, Sundays and Thursdays were dog walking days, but Blue had begged off the previous 2 weeks to spend time with the boys, so it felt like it had been a long time since she'd seen her dogs by proxy. The problem was that she was running distinctly low on money, and moreover, guilt at disobeying Maura was finally beginning to weigh on her. It had gotten so that she couldn't look her mother in the eye over dinner, but it was impossible now to imagine giving up the boys. She had to find a way to reconcile the two. But first, she had to walk the dogs. On the way out to Willow Ridge, the phone in the kitchen rang, and Blue, a glass of cloudy apple juice in one hand and the laces of a high-top sneaker in the other, grabbed it.
Hello?
I'd like to speak to Blue, please, if she's in. It was Gansey's unmistakable, polite voice, the one he used to turn straw into gold. Clearly he had known what he risked calling here, and clearly he had been prepared to speak to someone other than Blue about it. Despite her growing suspicion that her secrecy couldn't last, she wasn't sure how she felt about the fact that he could have blown her cover. Blue is getting ready to go walk other people's dogs, she said, setting down the juice and tugging on the sneaker, phone shoved between her ear and shoulder. And it's a good thing you got her and not someone else.
I was prepared for that eventuality, Gansey said.
It was strange to hear him over the phone. His voice didn't quite sound like his face looked.
Still, I'm glad I caught you.
How are you doing?
Well, I trust.
He doesn't mean to be condescending, Blue told herself. She told herself several times.
You trust right.
Brilliant. Look, Adam's working today and Ronan's at church with his brothers, but I'd like to go out and just look around, he added quickly. Not to the woods. I was thinking maybe to that church on your map. Do you want to?
He faltered.
Gansey was faltering?
It took Blue a moment of his silence to realize that he was asking if she wanted to go with him. It took her another moment to realize that she'd never been anywhere with him without the other boys.
I have to walk dogs.
Oh, Gansey replied, sounding deflated. Well, okay. But it'll only take an hour.
Oh, he repeated about 14 shades brighter. Shall I pick you up, then?
Blue glanced furtively over her shoulder toward the living room.
Oh, no. I'll meet you in the parking lot.
Brilliant, he said again. Top shelf. I think this will be interesting. See you in an hour.
Top shelf?
Gansey without Adam. Blue wasn't certain how this would work. Despite Adam's tentative interest in her, the boys seemed to act as a unit, a single, multi-headed entity. To see any of them without the presence of the others felt a little dangerous. But there wasn't an option of not going with Gansey. She wanted to explore as much as he did. No sooner had Blue hung up than she heard her name being called.
Blue, my child, come in here.
This was Maura's voice, and the sing-song rhythm to it was highly ironic. With a sinking sensation, Blue followed it into the living room where she found Maura, Calla, and Persephone drinking what Blue suspected were screwdrivers. When she walked into the room, the women all looked up at her with indolent smiles. A pack of lionesses. Blue raised her eyebrows at the cocktails. The morning light through the windows turned the drinks a brilliant translucent yellow. It's only 10 o'clock. Calla reached out, enclosing Blue's wrist with her fingers, and dragged her onto the mint-green love seat. Her glass was already mostly empty.
It's a Sunday. What else would we do?
I have to go walk dogs, Blue said.
From her blue-striped chair across the room, Maura sipped her screwdriver and made a wild face.
Oh, Persephone, you make them with far too much vodka.
My hand always slips,
Persephone said sadly from a wicker bench in front of the window. When Blue started to rise, Maura said, a thinly veiled iron behind her tone,
Sit with us a moment, Blue. Talk to us about yesterday, and the day before, and the day before, and, oh, let's just talk about these past few weeks.
Blue realized then that Maura was furious. She had seen her furious only a few times before, and having it directed at her made her skin go instantly clammy.
Well, I was.
She trailed off. A lie seemed pointless.
I'm not your dungeon master, interrupted Maura. I'm not going to bolt you in your room or send you to a convent for crying out loud. So you can just stop all the sneaking around stuff right now.
I wasn't.
You were. I have been your mother since you've been born, and I promise you, you were. So I take it you and Gansey get along, then?
Maura's expression was annoyingly knowing.
Mom? Orla told me about his muscle car, Maura continued.
Her voice was still angry and artificially bright. The fact that Blue was well aware that she'd earned it made the sting of it even worse.
You aren't planning on kissing him, are you?
Mom, that will never happen, Blue assured her.
You did meet him, didn't you?
I wasn't sure if driving an old loud Camaro was the male equivalent of shredding your T-shirts and gluing cardboard trees to your bedroom walls.
Trust me, Blue said. Gansey and I are nothing like each other. And they aren't cardboard, they're repurposed canvas.
The environment breathes a sigh of relief. Maura attempted another sip of her drink. Wrinkling her nose, she shot a glare at Persephone. Persephone looked martyred. After a pause, Maura noted in a slightly softer voice,
I'm not entirely happy that you're getting in a car without airbags.
Our car doesn't have airbags, Blue pointed out. Maura picked a long strand of Persephone's hair from the rim of her glass.
Yes, but you always take your bike.
Blue stood up. She suspected that the green fuzz of the sofa was now adhered to the back of her leggings.
Can I go now? Am I in trouble?
You are in trouble. I told you to stay away from him, and you didn't, Maura said.
I just haven't decided what to do about it yet. My feelings are hurt. I've consulted with several people who tell me that I'm within my rights to feel hurt. Do teenagers still get grounded? Did that only happen in the 80s?
I'll be very angry if you ground me, Blue said, still wobbly from her mother's unfamiliar displeasure.
I'll probably rebel and climb out my window with a bedsheet rope.
Her mother rubbed a hand over her face. Her anger had completely burned itself out.
You're well into it, aren't you? That didn't take long.
If you don't tell me not to see them, I don't have to disobey you, Blue suggested.
This is what you get, Maura, for using your DNA to make a baby, Calla said.
Maura sighed.
Blue, I know you're not an idiot. It's just sometimes smart people do dumb things.
Calla growled. Don't be one of them.
Persephone? Asked Maura.
In her small voice, Persephone said, I have nothing to add.
After a moment of consideration, she added, however,
If you are going to punch someone, don't put your thumb inside your fist. It would be a shame to break it.
Okay, Blue said hurriedly. I'm out.
You could at least say sorry, Maura said. Pretend like I have some power over you.
Blue wasn't sure how to reply to this.
Maura had all sorts of control of Blue, but it wasn't usually the sort that came with ultimatums or curfew. So she just said,
I'm sorry. I should have told you I was going to do what you didn't want me to do. Mora said, that was not as satisfying as I imagined it would be. Calla caught Blue's wrist again, and for a moment Blue was worried that Calla would sense the level of strangeness surrounding Gansey's quest. But she merely swallowed the last of her drink before purring,
What with all this running around, don't forget our movie night on Friday, Blue.
Our movie night, Blue repeated. Calla's eyebrows hardened.
You promised.
For a shapeless moment, Blue tried to remember when she had ever talked about a movie night with Calla, and then she realized what this was really about. The conversation from days and days ago about tossing Neve's room. I forgot that was this week, Blue replied. Mora swirled her drink, which still looked mostly full. She always preferred watching other people drink to doing it herself. Which movie?
Even dwarfs started small, Calla replied immediately. In the original German. Augsburger haben klein angefangen.
Mora winced, though Blue couldn't tell if it was at the movie or at Calla's accent. She said, just as well. Neve and I are out that evening. Calla raised an eyebrow, and Persephone picked at a string on her lace stockings. What are you doing? Blue asked.
Looking for my father. Scrying in pools.
Mora stopped swirling her drink. Not hanging out with Gansey. At least Blue could still be certain that her mother would never lie to her. She just wouldn't say anything at all. 28. Why the church? Blue asked from the passenger seat of the Camaro. She'd never ridden in the front before, and in the passenger seat, the sensation of the car being a few thousand parts flying in uneasy formation was even more pronounced. Gansey, installed comfortably behind the wheel with expensive sunglasses and topsiders, took his time answering. I don't know, because it's on the line, but it's not as whatever Cabeswater is. I have to think more about Cabeswater before we go back. Because it's like we're going into someone's house. Blue tried not to look at Gansey's boat shoes. She felt better about him as a person if she pretended he wasn't wearing them. Exactly. That's exactly what it feels like. He pointed at her like he pointed at Adam when Adam made a comment he approved of. Then he put his hand back on the gear shift knob to stop its rattling. Blue found it a thrilling idea, actually, that the trees were thinking creatures, that they could speak, that they knew her. Turn here, Blue ordered, as Gansey nearly passed the ruined church. With a broad smile, he hauled on the wheel and dropped down a few gears. With only a few protesting rubber noises, they made it into the overgrown drive. As they did, the glove box fell open and shot its contents onto Blue's lap. Why do you even have this car? She asked. Gansey shut off the engine, but her legs still felt like they vibrated in time with it. Because it is a classic, he replied primly. Because it's unique. But it's a piece of crap. Don't they make unique classics that don't? Blue demonstrated her point by unsuccessfully shoving the door to the glove box shut a few times. Now, as she reinserted the box's contents and slammed the door shut, it once again ejected its contents onto her legs. Oh, they do, Gansey said, and she thought she detected a bit of an edge to his voice. Not anger, really, but irony. He put a mint leaf in his mouth and climbed out of the car. Blue replaced the car's registration and an ancient strip of beef jerky in the glove box, and then she inspected the other object that had fallen into her lap. It was an EpiPen. A syringe meant to restart someone's heart in the case of a severe allergic reaction. Unlike the beef jerky, its expiration date was current. "Whose is this?" she asked. Gansey was already out of the car, holding the EMF reader and stretching as if he'd been in the car for hours instead of 30 minutes. She noticed that he had impressive arm muscles, probably related to the Aglenby rowing team sticker she'd noticed on the glove box. Glancing over his shoulder at her, he replied, dismissive, Mine. You've got to jimmy that latch to the right, then it'll shut. She did as he recommended, and sure enough, the glove box latched, the EpiPen safely replaced inside. On the other side of the car, Gansey tipped his head back to look at the storm clouds, living things, moving towers.
In the very deep distance, they were nearly the same color as the blue edge of the mountains. The road they'd come in on was a dappled blue-green river twisting back toward town. The indirect light of the sun was peculiar, nearly yellow, thick with humidity. Apart from the birds, there was no sound but the slow, faraway growl of thunder. "I hope the weather holds," he remarked. He strode over to the ruined church. This, Blue had discovered, was how Gansey got places, striding. Walking was for ordinary people. Standing beside him, Blue found the church eerier in the daylight, as she always did. Growing inside the ruined walls among collapsed bits of roof, knee-high grass, and trees as tall as her strove toward the sunlight. There was no evidence there had ever been any pews or any congregation. There was something bleak and meaningless about it. Death with no afterlife. She remembered standing here with Neve all those weeks ago. She wondered if Neve really was looking for her father, and if she was, what she intended to do with him if she found him. She thought about the spirits walking into the church, and she wondered if Gansey said, "I feel like I've been here before." Blue didn't know how to answer. She'd already told him one half-truth about St. Mark's Eve, and she wasn't sure it was right to tell him the other half. Moreover, she wasn't sure it felt true. Standing next to him in his very alive state, she couldn't imagine that he would be dead in less than a year. He was wearing a teal polo shirt, and it seemed impossible that someone in a teal polo shirt could perish of anything other than heart disease at age 86, possibly at a polo match. Blue asked, "What's your magical meter doing right now?" Gansey turned it toward her. His knuckles were pale, bone pressed through skin. Red lights flashed across the surface of the meter. He said, "It's pegged, same as in the wood." Blue surveyed their surroundings. In all likelihood, all of this was private property, even the ground the church was on. But the area behind the church looked more remote. "If we go that way, it seems less like we'll be shot for trespassing. We can't be low profile because of your shirt. Aquamarine is a wonderful color, and I won't be made to feel bad for wearing it," Gansey said. But his voice was a bit thin, and he glanced back at the church again. Just then he looked younger than she'd ever seen him, his eyes narrowed, hair messed up, features unstudied. Young, and strangely enough, afraid. Blue thought, "I can't tell him. I can never tell him. I have to just try to stop it from happening." Then Gansey, suddenly charming again, flipped a hand in the direction of her purple tunic dress. "Lead the way, eggplant." She found a stick to poke at the ground for snakes before they set off through the grass. The wind smelled like rain and the ground rumbled with thunder, but the weather held. The machine in Gansey's hands blinked red constantly, only flickering to orange when they stepped too far away from the invisible line. "Thanks for coming, Jane," Gansey said. Blue shot him a dirty look. "You're welcome, Dick." He looked pained. "Please don't." This genuine expression robbed all of the glee of using his real name. She kept walking. "You're the only one who doesn't seem fazed by this," he said after a moment. "It's not that I'm accustomed to it, but I've run across some unusual things before, and I guess I just... But Ronan and Adam and Noah all seem nonplussed." Blue pretended she knew what nonplussed meant. "I live with this, though. I mean, my mother is a psychic. All her friends are psychics. This is... Well, it's not like it's normal, but it's how I always thought it would feel to be them. You know, to see things that other people don't." "I spent years trying to get it to do this," Gansey admitted. There was something about the timbre of his voice that surprised Blue. It wasn't until he spoke again she realized he was using the tone she'd heard him use with Adam. "I've spent 18 months trying to find the Henrietta line." "Was it what you expected?" "I don't know what I expected. I'd read all about the effects of the line, but I never thought it would be so pronounced. So... I never expected the trees. I never expected it to happen so fast, either. I'm used to getting one clue every month and then beating that dead horse until another one comes along. Not this." He paused,
his smile wide and benevolent. "This is all down to you, putting us on the line, finally. I could kiss you." Though he was obviously joking, Blue skittered to the side. "What was that for?" she asked. "Do you believe in psychics?"
"Well, I went to one, didn't I?"
"That doesn't mean anything. Lots of people go to psychics just for a laugh. I went because I believe.
Well, I believe in ones that are good at what they do. I just think there's quite a lot of hooey you have to wade through to get to them. Why?"
Blue viciously stabbed the ground with her snake stick. "Because my mom's told me, ever since I was born, that if I kiss my true love, he'll die."
Gansey laughed.
"Don't laugh, you..." Blue was going to say, "bastard," but it felt too strong and she lost the nerve.
"Well, it's just a very precautionary-sounding sort of thing, isn't it? Don't date or you'll go blind. Kiss your true love and he bites it."
"It's not just her," Blue protested. "Every psychic or medium I've ever met tells me the same thing. Besides, my mom's not like that. She wouldn't just play around with something like that. It's not pretend."
"Sorry," Gansey said, realizing she was genuinely annoyed with him. "I was being a dick again. Do you know how he's supposed to die, this unlucky guy?"
Blue shrugged.
"Ah, devil's in the details, I guess. So you just kiss nobody in a precautionary way?"
He watched her nod.
"That seems grim, Jane. I won't lie."
She shrugged again.
"I don't usually tell people. I don't know why I told you. Don't tell Adam."
Gansey's eyebrows spiked up toward his hairline.
"It's like that, is it?"
Her face went instantly hot.
"No. I mean, no. No! It's just because it's not... because I don't know. I would rather play it safe."
Blue fantasized that time had begun again with them getting out of the car and her instead striking up a conversation about the weather or which classes he was taking.
It didn't seem like her face would ever stop burning.
Gansey's voice when he replied was a little rough.
"Well, if you killed Adam, I'd be quite upset."
"I'll do my best not to." For a moment, the silence was uneven and uncomfortable, and then he said, his voice more ordinary, "Thanks for telling me. I mean, trusting me with something like that."
Relieved, Blue replied,
"Well, you told me about how you felt about Ronan and Adam and the non-plussing thing. Only I still want to know, why are you looking for Glendower?"
He smiled ruefully, and for a moment Blue was afraid that he was about to switch over to flippant, glossy Gansey. But in the end he just said,
"It's a difficult story to summarize."
"You're in a pre-Ivy League high school. Try."
"All right. Where to start?"
"Maybe... you saw my EpiPen. It's for bee stings. I'm allergic, badly."
Blue stopped in her tracks, alarmed. Hornets nested on the ground, and this was prime territory for them. Quiet areas close to trees.
"Gansey, this is the countryside where bees live."
He made a dismissive gesture as if eager to be off this particular subject.
"Keep poking things with your stick and it'll be okay."
"My stick? All week we've been walking in the woods. That seems awfully..."
"Cavalier," Gansey suggested. "The truth is that there's not even really a point having an EpiPen. The last they told me was that it would only work if I got stung once, and even then they don't know. I was 4 the first time I had to go to a hospital for a sting, and the reactions only got worse after that. It is what it is. It's this or live in a bubble."
Blue thought about the death card and how her mother hadn't actually interpreted it for Gansey. It was possible, she thought, that the card hadn't been about Gansey's foretold tragedy at all, but rather about his life, how he walked side by side with death every day. With her stick, Blue thwacked the ground ahead of them.
"Okay, go on."
Gansey sucked in his lips and then released them.
"Well, 7 years ago, I was at a dinner party with my parents. I can't remember what it was for. I think one of my dad's friends had gotten the party nomination."
"For Congress?"
The ground beneath their feet or the air around them vibrated with thunder.
"Yeah,
I don't remember. You know how you sometimes don't remember everything, right? Ronan says that memories are like dreams. You never remember how you got to the front of the classroom with no clothes on. Anyway, the party was dull. I was 9 or 10. It was all little black dresses and red ties and any sort of food you wanted as long as it was shrimp. A few of us kids started to play hide and seek. I remember thinking I was too old to play hide and seek, but there was nothing else to do. Blue and he entered a narrow copse of trees, sparse enough that grass grew between them instead of brambles. This Gansey, this storytelling Gansey, was a different person altogether from any of the other versions of him she'd encountered. She couldn't not listen. It was hot as Hades. It was spring, but it had suddenly decided it was summer. Virginia spring. You know how that is. Heavy, somehow. There was no shade in the backyard, but there was this great forest that bounded it, dark and green and blue, like diving into a lake. In I went, and it was fantastic. Only 5 minutes, and I couldn't see the house. Blue stopped poking the ground. Did you get lost? Gansey shook his head a little. I stepped on a nest. His eyes were narrowed in that way people do when they're trying hard to appear casual, but it was obvious this story was anything but casual to him. Hornets, like you said. They nest on the ground. I don't have to tell you. But I didn't know back then. The first thing I felt was a little prickle on my sock. I thought I'd stepped on a thorn. There were a ton of them, those green, whip-shaped ones. But then I felt another. They were just such small hurts, you know? Blue felt a little sick. He continued, but then I felt one on my hand, and by the time I jumped away, I saw them all over my arms. Somehow he'd managed to take her there, to put her in that moment of discovery. Blue's heart felt dragged down, snared with venom. "What did you do?" she asked. "I knew I was dead. I knew I was dead before I started to feel everything start to go wrong in my body, because I'd been to the hospital for just one sting, and this was like 100. They were in my hair. They were in my ears, Blue." She asked, "Were you scared?" He didn't have to answer. She saw it in the hollow of his eyes. "What happened?" "I died," he said. "I felt my heart stop. The hornets didn't care. They were still stinging me, even though I was dead." Gansey stopped. He said, "This is the difficult part." "Those are my favorite," Blue replied. The trees were quiet around them. The only sound was the growl of thunder. After a pause, she added a little ashamed, "Sorry, I didn't mean to be. But my whole life is the difficult part. Nobody believes in what my family does. I'm not going to laugh." He exhaled slowly. "I heard a voice. It was a whisper. I won't forget what it said. It said, 'You will live because of Glendower. Someone else on the ley line is dying when they should not, and so you will live when you should not.'" Blue was very quiet. The air pressed on them. "I told Helen. She said it was a hallucination." Gansey brushed a hanging vine from his face. The brush was getting thicker here, the trees closer. They probably needed to turn back. His voice was peculiar, formal and certain. "It was not a hallucination." This was the Gansey who had written the journal. The truth of it, the magic of it, possessed her. She asked, "And that's enough to make you spend your life looking for Glendower?" Gansey replied, "Once Arthur knew the Grail existed, how could he not look for it?" Thunder growled beneath them again, the hungry snarl of an invisible beast. Blue said, "That's not really an answer." He didn't look at her. He replied, voice terrible, "I need to, Blue." Every light on the EMF reader went out.
equal parts relieved to be back on safe ground and disappointed not to pry deeper into the real Gansey, Blue touched the machine. Did we step off the line? They retreated several yards, but the machine didn't turn back on. Is the battery dead? She suggested. I don't know how to check. Gansey switched it off and then on again. Blue stretched out her hand for the reader. The moment she took it from him, the lights burst red. Solid red. No blinking. She turned from side to side. Orange to her left. Red to her right. They met each other's eyes. Take it back, Blue said. But as soon as Gansey touched the EMF reader, the lights went dead again. When the thunder came this time, seductive and simmering, she felt like it started something inside her trembling that didn't stop after the sound had died. I keep thinking there must be a logical explanation, Gansey said, but there hasn't been all week. Blue thought there probably was a logical explanation, and she thought it was this. Blue made things louder, only she had no idea what she was amplifying at the moment. The air shuddered again as thunder grumbled. There was no sign of the sun now. All that was left was the heavy green air around them. He asked, "Where is it steering us?" Letting the solid red light lead them, Blue stepped hesitantly through the trees. They had only made it a few yards when the machine went dead again. No amount of switching hands or manipulation would encourage it to flicker again. They stood with the machine between them. Heads bowed close, looking silently at the dark face of it. Blue asked, "What now?" Gansey stared down between their feet directly below the machine. "Step back. There's..." "Oh my gosh," Blue said, jerking away from Gansey. Then again, "Oh my..." But she couldn't finish the sentence, because she had just stepped off something that looked an awful lot like a human arm bone. Gansey was the first to crouch, brushing away the leaves from the bone. Sure enough, beneath the first arm bone was a second. A filthy watch encircled the wrist bone. Everything looked fake, a skeleton in the woods. "This can't be happening." "Oh no," Blue breathed. "Don't touch it. Fingerprints." But the corpse was long beyond fingerprints. The bones were clean as a museum piece, the flesh long since rotted off, and there were only threads remaining of whatever the person had worn. Picking carefully at leaves, Gansey uncovered the entire skeleton. It lay crumpled, one leg crooked up, arms sprawled to either side of its skull, a freeze frame of tragedy. Time had spared strange elements and taken others. The watch was there, but the hand was not. The shirt was gone, but a tie remained, rippled over the hills and valleys of the collapsed rib bones. The shoes were dirty, but unchanged from exposure. The socks, too, were preserved inside the leather shoes, ankle-height bags of foot bones. The skull's cheek was smashed in. She wondered if that was how the person had died. "Gansey," Blue said, voice flat. "This was a kid. This was a kid from Aglenby." She pointed at his rib cage. Crooked between two bare ribs was an Aglenby patch, the synthetic fibers of the embroidery impervious to the weather. They stared at each other over the body. Lightning lit the sides of their faces. Blue was very aware of the skull beneath Gansey's skin, his cheekbones so close to the surface, high and square like those on the death card. "We should report it," she said. "Wait," he replied. It only took him a moment to find the wallet beneath the hip bone. It was good leather, spattered and bleached, but mostly unmolested. Gansey flipped it open, eyeing the multicolored edges of credit cards that lined one side. He spotted the top edge of a driver's license and thumbed it out. Blue heard Gansey's breath catch in naked shock. The face on the driver's license was Noah's. 29. At 8 p.m., Gansey called Adam at the trailer factory. "I'm coming to get you," he said, and hung up. He didn't say it was important, but this was the first time he'd ever asked for Adam to leave work, so it had to be. Outside, the Camaro idled in the parking lot, the uneven tripping of the engine echoing across the darkness. Adam got in.
"I'll explain when we get there," said Gansey.
He put the car into gear, stomping the gas hard enough that the back tire squeaked on the asphalt as they left. From Gansey's expression, Adam thought that something had happened to Ronan. Maybe finally Ronan had happened to Ronan. But it wasn't the hospital that they drove to. The Camaro tore straight into the lot outside Monmouth Manufacturing. Together, they climbed the dark, creaking stairs to the second floor. Under Gansey's hands, the door fell open, crashing against the wall.
"Noah!" he shouted.
The room stretched out, limitless in the dark. Against the windows, the miniature Henrietta was a false skyline. Gansey's alarm clock beeped continuously, sounding a warning for a time that had long since passed. Adam's fingers searched unsuccessfully for the light switch.
Gansey shouted again, "We need to talk! Noah!"
The door to Ronan's room opened, releasing a square of light. Ronan was silhouetted in the doorway, one hand curled against his chest, the raven foundling hunched down between his fingers. He pulled a pair of silkily expensive headphones from his ears and looped them around his neck.
"Man, you're back late. Parrish? I thought you were working."
So Ronan knew no more than Adam did. Adam felt a cold bit of relief over this, which he quickly extinguished.
"I was." Adam finally found the light switch.
The room was transformed into a twilight planet, the corners alive with sharp-mouthed shadows.
"Where's Noah?" demanded Gansey. He jerked the alarm clock's power cord out of the wall to silence it.
Ronan took in Gansey's state and raised an eyebrow.
"He's out."
"No," Gansey said, emphatic. "He is not. Noah!"
He backed into the center of the room, turning to look at the corners, the rafters, searching places no one would ever find a roommate. Adam hesitated by the door. He couldn't figure out how this could be over Noah. Noah, who could go unnoticed for hours, whose room was pristine, whose voice was never raised.
Gansey stopped searching and turned to Adam.
"Adam," he demanded, "what is Noah's last name?"
Before Gansey had asked, Adam felt as if he must have known. But now, the answer slid away from his mouth, and then from his thoughts entirely, leaving his lips parted. It was like losing his way to class, losing his way home, forgetting the phone number for Monmouth Manufacturing.
"I don't know," Adam admitted.
Gansey pointed at Adam's chest like he was shooting a gun or making a point.
"It's Czerny, by the way. Czerny, Czerny, however it's pronounced. Noah Czerny."
Throwing his head back, he shouted to the air,
"I know you're here, Noah!"
"Dude," Ronan remarked, "you're flipped."
"Open his door," Gansey ordered. "Tell me what's in there."
With a graceful shrug, Ronan slid out of his doorway and turned the knob on Noah's door. It fell open, revealing the corner of an always-made bed.
"It looks like a nunnery, as usual," Ronan said. "All the personality of a mental facility. What am I looking for? Drugs? Girls? Guns?"
"Tell me," Gansey said, "which classes you share with Noah."
Ronan snorted. "None."
"Me neither," Gansey replied. He looked at Adam, who shook his head slightly.
"Nor Adam. How is that possible?"
He didn't wait for an answer, though.
"When does he eat?
Have you ever seen him eat?"
"I don't really care," Ronan said.
He stroked Chainsaw's head with a single finger, and she tilted her beak up in response. It was a strange moment in a strange evening, and if it had happened the day before, it would have struck Adam that he rarely saw such thoughtless kindness from Ronan.
Gansey shot questions at both of them. "Does he pay rent? When did he move in? Have you ever questioned it?"
Ronan shook his head.
"Dude, you have really left the reservation. What is your problem?"
"I spent the afternoon with the police," Gansey said. "I went out with Blue to the church."
Now jealousy stabbed Adam. deep and unexpected, a wound that kept stinging, no less painful for him not being certain what precisely had inflicted it. Ganzi continued, "Don't look at me like that, both of you. The point is this. We found a body, rotted to bones. Do you know whose it was?" Ronan's gaze held Ganzi's, solid. Adam felt like he had dreamt the answer to this question. Behind them, the door to the apartment suddenly slammed shut. They whirled to face it, but there was no one there, only the fluttering of map corners on the wall to show that it had moved. The boys stared at the subtle movement of the paper, listened to the echo of the slam. There was no breeze. Adam's skin crawled. "Mine," Noah said. As one, they spun back around. Noah stood in the doorway to his room. His skin was pale as parchment, and his eyes were shadowed and unspecific as they always were after dark. There was the ubiquitous smudge on his face, only now it looked like dirt or blood, or possibly like a hollow, his bones crushed beneath his skin. Ronan's posture was wound tight. "Your room was empty. I just looked in it."
"I told you," Noah said. "I told everyone."
Adam had to close his eyes for a long moment. Ganzi, if anything, looked finally back under control. What Ganzi needed out of life was facts, things he could write in his journal, things he could state twice and underline, no matter how improbable those facts were. Adam realized that all along, Ganzi had not really known what he was going to find when he'd brought Adam back here. How could he have? How could anyone truly believe? "He's dead," Ganzi said. His arms were tight over his chest. "You're really dead, aren't you?" Noah's voice was plaintive.
"I told you."
They stared at him, just feet away from Ronan. Really, he was so much less real than Ronan, Adam thought. It should have been obvious. It was ludicrous that they hadn't noticed. Ridiculous that they had not thought about his last name, about where he came from, about the classes he did or did not go to. His clammy hands, his pristine room, his unchanging, smudgy face. He had been dead as long as they'd known him. Reality was a bridge breaking beneath Adam. "Shit, man," Ronan said finally, a little desperate. "All those nights you gave me grief about keeping you awake and you don't even need to sleep." Adam asked, barely audible,
"How did you die?"
Noah turned his face away. "No," Ganzi said, purpose crystallized in the word. "That's not the question, is it? The question is, who killed you?" Now Noah wore the retreating expression that came when something made him uncomfortable. His chin turned, his eyes hooded and alien. Adam was suddenly profoundly aware that Noah was a dead thing and he was not. "If you can tell me," Ganzi said, "I can find a way to put the police on the trail." Noah's chin ducked farther, his expression somehow black, his eye sockets hollowed and skull-like. Were they looking at a boy or something that looked like a boy? Adam wanted to say, "Don't push him, Ganzi." In Ronan's hands, Chainsaw began to scream. Bright, frantic caws that split the air. It was as if there was nothing in the world but the sound of her frenzied cries. It seemed impossible that such a small body could make such a huge sound. Noah lifted his head, his eyes wide open and ordinary. He looked frightened. Ronan folded a hand over Chainsaw's head until she quieted. Noah said,
"I don't want to talk about it."
His shoulders were drawn up around his ears, and he looked now like the Noah that they had always known, the Noah they had never questioned as being one of them, one of the living. "Okay," said Ganzi. Then again, "Okay, what would you like to do?"
"I'd like..." Noah began trailing off as he always did, shrinking back into his room.
Was this what Noah did when he was alive, Adam wondered? Or was this a function of being dead,
of trying to hold an ordinary conversation. Ronan and Adam both glanced to Gansey at once. It seemed like there was nothing to be done or said. Even Ronan seemed subdued, his normal barbs hidden. Until they were sure what the new rules were, he too seemed reluctant to find out how otherworldly Noah could be when provoked. Looking away from the others, Gansey asked, "Noah?" The space in Noah's doorway was empty. At the threshold of Noah's room, Ronan pushed the door all the way open. The room inside was stark and untouched, the bed so clearly unslept in. The world hummed around Adam, suddenly charged with possibilities, not all of them pleasant. He felt like he was sleepwalking. Nothing was the truth until he could put his hands on it. Ronan began to swear, long and filthy and continuous, without stopping for breath. Gansey's thumb worried over his bottom lip. He asked Adam, "What's going on?" Adam replied, "We're being haunted."
30. Blue was more distressed than she thought she would have been by the fact that Noah was dead. From talking to the police, it was clear that he'd never been alive, at least not since she'd met him, but still, she felt a curious grief over it. For starters, Noah's presence in Monmouth changed distinctly after they discovered his body. They never seemed to get the entire Noah anymore. Gansey would hear Noah's voice in the parking lot, or Blue would see his shadow fall across the sidewalk as she headed over to Monmouth, or Ronan would find scratches on his skin. He had always been a ghost, but now he was acting it.
"Maybe," Adam had suggested, "it's because his body's been removed from the ley line."
Blue just kept thinking of the skull with its face smashed in, of Noah retching at the sight of the Mustang, not throwing up, just going through the actions of it, because he was dead. She wanted to find whoever did it, and she wanted him to fester in a cell for the rest of his life. Blue was so engrossed in Noah's plight that she nearly forgot that she and Calla were supposed to search Neve's room on Friday. Calla must have recognized that she was distracted because she'd left a cheekily obvious note on the fridge for Blue to find before school.
"Blue, don't forget movie night tonight."
Swiping the sticky note from the door, Blue stuffed it into her backpack.
"Blue?" Neve said.
Blue jumped as far into the air as a human being could manage, spinning at the same time. Neve sat at the kitchen table, a mug of tea in front of her, a book in her hand. She wore a cream shirt the precise color of the curtains behind her.
"I didn't see you there," Blue gasped. The sticky note in her backpack felt like a burning confession.
Neve smiled mildly and placed her book face down.
"I haven't seen much of you this week."
"I've been out with friends." Between each word, Blue told herself to stop sounding suspicious.
"I've heard about Gansey," Neve said. "I advised Maura that it wasn't wise to try to keep you apart. You're clearly meant to cross paths."
Thanks for that."
"You seem distressed," Neve said. With one of her lovely hands, she patted the seat of the chair beside her. "Would you like me to look at anything for you? Do a reading?"
"Oh, thanks for that, but I can. I have to make it to school," Blue said quickly. Part of her wondered if Neve asked these things out of kindness, or if she asked them out of reverse psychology because she knew what Calla and Blue were planning. Either way, Blue didn't want any part of the scrying Neve did. Bundling her things toward the doorway, she did a kind of casual half-wave over her shoulder. She had made it only a few steps when Neve said to her back,
"You're looking for a god. Didn't you suspect that there was also a devil?"
Blue froze in the doorway. She turned her head, but didn't quite face Neve.
"Oh, I haven't been poking around," Neve said. "What you're doing is big enough for me to see while I'm looking at other things."
Now Blue faced her. Neve's mild expression hadn't changed. Her hands were cupped around the mug.
"Numbers are easy for me," Neve said. "They came first, really. I could always pull them out of thin air.
important dates, telephone numbers. They're the easiest. But death's the next easiest. I can tell when someone's touched it. Blue clutched her backpack straps. Her mother and her friends were strange, yes, but they knew they were strange. They knew when they were saying something weird. Neve didn't seem to have that filter. She replied finally, "He'd been dead a long time." Neve shrugged. "There'll be more before it's done." Lost for words, Blue just slowly shook her head. "I'm just warning you," Neve said. "Watch for the devil. When there's a god, there's always a legion of devils."
31. For the first time ever, Adam wasn't happy to have a day off from Aglenby. With Friday, a scheduled teacher work day, Gansey had reluctantly gone to his parents for his mother's belated birthday. Ronan was drinking and boorish in his room, and Adam was left studying at Gansey's desk at Monmouth Manufacturing in his absence. The public school had classes as normal, but he could always hope that Blue would come over when she was done. The apartment felt oppressive without anyone else in the main room. Part of Adam wanted to lure Ronan out of his room for company, but most of him realized that Ronan was, in his unappealing and unspoken way, grieving for Noah. So Adam remained at Gansey's desk, scratching at some Latin homework, aware that the light that came in the windows didn't seem to light the floorboards as well as it ordinarily did. The shadows shifted and clung. Adam smelled the mint plant on Gansey's desk, but he also smelled Noah, that combination of his deodorant and soap and sweat. "Noah," Adam said to the empty apartment, "are you here, or are you out haunting Gansey?" There was no response. He looked down at his paper. The Latin verbs looked nonsensical.